I'm an alcoholic. My name is Cindy Hawks. Thank you, Stephen, for asking me to be here. It is an honor and always amazing to me, as I said earlier, that anybody wants to hear what I have to say. So I'm delighted to be here. So I will tell you that I get very nervous doing this, and I say when I'm nervous, so but you'll know when God kicks in, hopefully, because that will stop. But I will start with some housekeeping to help settle the nerves. So my sobriety date is March 31st, 2012. I have a sponsor who is indeed on here tonight, and you're absolutely right, Stephen. I know to tell the truth. And I also saw a sobriety sister who is on here, and she doesn't have any trouble calling me out either. So I'm in good company tonight. That's good for y'all. I have a sponsor, as I said, and I sponsor women. And that's a really big deal to me. That has been a game changer in my journey. And I have a home group. It is the spiritual group. We meet on Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. at the club in High Point, which I'm from North Carolina, in case y'all can't tell by how I talk. But if you're ever in High Point, we would love for you to come and join us. So I will start at the beginning, I guess. My job is to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I also hope that I'll do what the book asked me to do, which is to convey properly how I entered this relationship with my power, whom I choose to call God. So I was born in a little blink of an eye town called Hudson, North Carolina, and I was born into a home that was filled with untreated alcoholism. And if you would have said that term to me 10 years ago, I wouldn't have known what you meant by that. But I'm well aware today what that disease looks like and feels like. And thank goodness for this process, for good sponsorship, for people like you in rooms like these that teach me what I have and that give me the solution to treat it. I don't think I could properly express my gratitude for that. So my dad was an alcoholic. He died at a younger age than I am from untreated alcoholism as a direct result of this disease. And on the outside, my home looked good. It looked great. And we always had what we needed. My dad was one of us, so he was a fun guy. And my mother was untreated Al-Anon, and so she was always trying to fix him. But he was a blast to be around, and he was generous and fun and big-hearted. But he was a sick alcoholic, and so there was a lot of chaos in my home. I was a drama queen from the beginning. So when I was one, I drank ammonia. When I was two, I drank gasoline. And when I was three, I ate pokeberries. And all three times, I had to have my stomach pumped. So I was always looking for attention and to be the center of the universe. And still, as my sponsor will nod probably when I say this, can fall back into that really quickly. But I have an older brother. He is 3 years older than I am. And my mother was raised in an alcoholic home as well. I have several uncles that have also died as a direct result of this disease, one from suicide, one from an overdose. And I used to spend a lot of time worrying about why I'm an alcoholic and where it came from. But I heard a speaker say early on, it really doesn't matter how the jackass got in the ditch. What are you going to do? And so that's most days my focus is, what am I going to do to stay out of the ditch? I will tell you also, since I mentioned speakers, that I, from the beginning, have been a speaker tape junkie. And I'm so grateful for folks who record speakers like Stephen is doing tonight, and for those who do that at conferences, because before I could grasp the steps, before I could grasp the actions I needed to take, I could listen to speaker tapes. And man, they saved me. And I listen to them over and over. I also say that to share with you that I will parrot the things I've heard. And I'm a plagiarist also. So if you're on this meeting and you hear you've been recorded and you hear something you said, just remember imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, because I will echo what I've learned in this program. And everything that means anything to me and that has helped me came from someone else and got passed down. And I'm so grateful for that. So you may hear things you've heard before, and if it came from you, just take that as a compliment. But so my dad, he was a fun guy. He drank with folks who drank like he did, as we do. And weekends at my house were the men in the backyard drinking bourbon and Sundrop, and the women were in the kitchen bitching about the men in the backyard. And I decided early on I wanted to be in the backyard because that looked like a whole lot more fun. So my dad also had, and this is my icebreaker because I'm not a good joke teller, but my dad also enjoyed Playboy magazines. And so he had those peppered all throughout our house. And when I was 6, I would bring all the neighborhood boys into our home to the hall bathroom and charge them a quarter to see the Playboy magazines. That's how I made my candy money. So I was also a con artist from the beginning. And that is a funny story, and it always helps me relax a little bit, because if I could hear y'all, I hope you're laughing. But it's also an example of the sickness that was in my home. And early on, there was always a focus on how things looked on the outside, always. And so we looked normal. My mom had us in church. My dad fought that. He didn't like being in church, so there was always that conflict. And there was just a lot of chaos, as you have in an alcoholic home. And I did really well in school. I had to have a boyfriend always. So at an early age, 11 and a half, I started dating. I dated one of my brother's friends who was 18. I thought that was really cool at the time. And now I know it's really sick and twisted. But how I felt about me always came from how I thought you felt about me. And the part of the instruction that I'm supposed to share with you what I was like, that's difficult for me because I had no idea what I was like. I was really like a leaf. Any wind could blow me. I was taught morals. I was taught values, but I didn't have any anchorage, if that makes sense. I was introduced to church and God at an early age, but I did not have a relationship with that. And I was always driven by people. And that's always where my sense of being okay came from. When I was around 11, same age, 11, 12, I experienced abuse at the hands of one of my father's friends who was drunk and a sick person. And I was not able to talk about that at that time. I was not able to share that with anybody. I carried that with me until I got to you. And I will share with you now one of the most valuable tools that helped me deal with that in AA was the 4-step. When I got to that person on my inventory, I was stuck, and I called my sponsor and said, man, I don't see my part in this. I was working on that 4th column. What's my part? And I couldn't see it. And I was stuck and hung up on that because it had a strong impact my whole life. And she said, you know what, Cindy, you're absolutely right in that you didn't control that. And you didn't cause that. You were a child. But how have you allowed that to impact you as an adult? And that wisdom was a game changer for me. And I just share that with you now because I know there's a lot of people who have had those same experiences. And the ability to let go and forgive that person and look at my part and how I allowed it to shape my view of myself, that has changed my life. That has changed my point of view on everything. So I always want to make sure I share that with folks when I speak. But back to the little girl in Hickory. So I, as I said, our home was on the outside. We always had everything we needed. It was kind of chaos on the inside. I kind of just was a chameleon, and whoever I hung out with, that's who I became. So I had the 18-year-old boyfriend when I was 11, and I got into some trouble with that. And so my mother was always intent on church is the answer, church, church, church. So I flipped and went the other way and got very involved in church and in youth group. And that is where that contact with this power that means so much to me now started. And I had times of intense relationship with that power where I could feel a presence, where I knew there was something real that wanted to be in relationship with me. But I also had a lot of old ideas about that power, that it was based on my performance, and so I could never measure up. And my story could really be summed up. I was really like that little girl who had a curl right in the middle of her forehead. When she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was horrid. So I was great in school. I made good grades only because it came very natural to me and it was very easy. I didn't know how to do anything that required stamina or perseverance. I was great coming out of the gate, but I was low on stamina for sure. And so I did great in school. I was always with the popular kids. Sports did not come easily, so I didn't do that because it was hard. And if it was hard, I didn't do it. I had one of the first points of identification for me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I heard you say you felt different always. And that was me. I always felt not quite enough, not pretty enough, not smart enough, not funny enough. My first drink of alcohol was probably when I was about 11 or 12. I remember taking Budweiser's to my dad and having sips of beer. My brother and his friends partied a lot. I don't remember my first drink. I don't have a great story about that like a lot of people do. But I know that it was probably about the age of 12. And every single time I drank alcoholically. When I drank, that was a spiritual experience from the beginning because everything changed. You changed. I changed. The world changed. I got comfortable in my own skin and everything was okay. And I could never control how much I drank. So I started at a young age having these multiple lives where I did great in school. I was involved in church. I had it going on and I could sum up my story by saying that my whole life has been spent trying to fix an internal problem with an external solution. And if I can make it look good on the outside, then everything was okay in my mind. And so I graduated at the top of my class. I went from the creepy 18-year-old boyfriend to the church boyfriend. And I had a high school basketball star boyfriend. And that was how I defined myself, was by a relationship with somebody else. That was my defining point. I had no sense of who I was. So I went to Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And from the little town I was from, that was a big deal. So I went from being a big fish in a little pond to being a little tiny fish in a big pond. And it was not a great place for a budding alcoholic to be. But I loved it, I think, because I don't remember a whole lot about it. But I remember where I lived, and that was at a place called Trolls Bar. I found my people at Chapel Hill, and there's a friend of ours in High Point, Kevin W., who always says that there are two places that I feel at home. And one is bellied up to a bar, and the second one is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that has been absolutely my truth. So I felt at home in Trolls Bar. Now, this was a hole in the wall. It was a dive. It was a honky-tonk, and man, were those my favorite kind of places. It had concrete floors and college kids and businessmen and bikers and cowboys and all kinds of people were there. And I had a very special friendship, I'll just leave it that way, with the bartender. And so I lived pretty much in that bar all 4 years. And I studied for exams there. I danced on tables there. I did all kinds of things there. And that was where my comfort was. And that's where I found people like me who drank like I did. Somehow I managed to graduate, just barely, by the skin of my teeth. And I did a lot of crazy things that we do. Y'all probably don't need instructions on that, or you wouldn't be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Tuesday night. But I always drank until I couldn't. And I drank until I had to stop, and I stopped until I had to drink. And that's how it was for me. I drove to the bar one night with my hand in the door of the car, and I got there and I was didn't even know it until I got there. And when I pulled in, the bartender saw me and he just poured a pitcher of Pabst Blue Ribbon 250 a pitcher, and I stuck my hand in that bar in that pitcher and just kept on drinking. That was kind of how I rolled. And so when I was a junior that summer, I moved to the beach and lived with a friend of mine who drank like I did. And there, I moved into the Mermaid, which is another same kind of place. I just always found those places, and I always found us wherever I went. And while I was there, I met a boy, shocker. I know y'all are surprised by that. And I was at a place where I didn't know, I was getting ready to graduate. I didn't know what to do next because I had no clue who I was. I had changed majors 5 times, and so I didn't know what to do. And this guy asked me to marry him, and I just said yes because this was somewhere for me to go. The thought of living on my own terrified me. The thought of going back to Hickory terrified me. So I just went to the next thing. And so I said yes to this guy. He was from Georgia. I went to meet his family, and his mother showed up at the door, and she had a Bloody Mary in both hands and said, "Welcome to the family." And I thought, I'm home. This is awesome. Because women in my house did not drink. Remember, they were always in the kitchen bitching about the men who were drinking. So to be in a house where the woman of the home drank was amazing to me. And we had wine with dinner, and I thought that was so sophisticated. And if there was a normal time in my life, which now I truly believe that's just a setting on the dryer, but if there was a normal time in my life, that was it. And I did not have to, at that point, drink every day. I could say, yes, I'll drink, or no, I won't drink. But I could never say when I did drink when I was going to stop. It was always up to the drink to decide that. And so my marriage could be very chaotic depending on how I was. And every relationship I was in, I used to wonder why the person I was with ended up putting their hand through the wall or had anger issues or rage problems. And, when I got to you, I figured out I was the common denominator with that, but it was always somebody else's fault. And if I was not happy and things were not right, it was always you. The idea of self-examination or seeing what was wrong with me, that was a foreign idea when I got here. I didn't have a clue how to do that because it was always somebody else's fault. So the marriage was rocky when I drank. You know, I dictated that. And I will tell you that I was not a faithful wife. I'm not proud of that. But I was always trying to fill that place inside of me. Our friend Jerry S. in High Point talks about there's this God-shaped hole inside, and I was always trying to fill that up with something to make myself feel okay and to make me be okay with the world. And when I drank, I felt that way. Alcohol did that for me. And so we had these two little girls, and I fell up the ladder, as we said, into a career that I just happened to be pretty good at. I wasn't really trying. It came very natural to me. And life went on. And then I got promoted and moved back to North Carolina. And when I did that, I met another boy, and that's not really cool because I was still married to the first boy. And again, I'm not proud of that. But all the morals, all the values, all the things I really believed in, I had nothing to sustain me to carry those out because I was always so full of self and so full of me. And when I left that marriage, it was like changing a dress. I didn't care about that husband. I was hurting. I didn't care about those two daughters who anybody that knows me can tell you they are still the loves of my life. And I didn't think about that at that time. I just had this thing inside of me that just had to be filled with something. And so the second boy had his own issues, and we just started this contest, really, of out-sicking each other. That was what we did. And our home, my home, became way more toxic than the one that I grew up in. And right before all that happened, I had gone home to Hickory to visit my family. And my mom had called me aside and said, I need to share something with you. Your dad has cirrhosis of the liver. And he had had emergency room episodes where his esophagus would burst, and I didn't understand what that was. I didn't understand anything about alcoholism. And she said, he is an alcoholic. And that was the first time I ever heard that word. And I didn't really know what it meant. But that's all was said about that. And he had a surgery, and 6 weeks later, he died from cirrhosis. And so I never dealt with that. I never processed that. And I was his little girl and the apple of his eye. And I never dealt with his death. I just never processed that at all. So fast forward back to this second marriage, and I'm in this contest with this other sick person, and I will tell you that there were things that happened in my home that no child should have to be around, that I would pick my daughters up in a condition that no mother should be in, and I was starting to come unglued. I had all these multiple lives going. I had the mommy life. My kids were in church, so I felt like I should be in church, and that was a large part of my childhood. So I tried to do that for them. And you know how we do things. I taught Sunday school. I was on the personnel committee. I was on the finance committee. So I had that life going. I had the mommy life going, being involved at school. I had the work life going. And then I had this other life, and most of that was spent in the bathroom, away from other people. I always had to have something to change how I felt. And so so in my career, I was starting to kind of come unglued. I was bringing alcohol in at the end of the day when we had a good day at work. Turns out employers frown upon that. So I made this decision to change jobs. And the truth was, I would have told you then that it was so I could be at home and be present for my children, because I was working from home then. I found a job where I could work from home. But the truth is, I was coming unglued, and I just couldn't hold it together. anymore. And so now I'm at home alone all day with just me. And again, that is not a good place to be. And so I was a marketing director, and I would do a lot of trade shows. And now I'm in this, still in this sick marriage where we are starting this. I love you. I hate you. I wish you were dead. I can't live without you. When I came into AA, one of the first speakers that I heard was Dorothy O. And she talked about two sickos don't make a wello. And that was one of the first points of identification for me, because we were both really, really sick. And I kept thinking he could fix me. And that he was one of my drugs for sure. And so I went to Las Vegas on a trip. It was a trade show, and if y'all have been in sales, you know they're like professional frat parties. And that night, there was a martini bar, all the martinis you could drink. And I woke up the next morning with that same old thing, who, what, when, where, how did I get here? And I thought, you know what my problem is. My problem is vodka. I know what I'm like when I drink vodka. So that's my problem. So I made a decision I was going to switch to wine because it's so sophisticated. Not the way I drink it, it wasn't. So then I started taking wine glasses, and I was going to learn all about it, wine tasting. And, you know, when you go to those wine tastings and they have the little glasses all around, well, I was going around behind everybody finishing theirs. That's not normal behavior. I know that now. So, long story short, I started spiraling and separated from that marriage and bought my own house. And now I'm living in my house by myself. I had decided that he was my problem. I had already changed husbands once. I had, changed jobs. Now if I just have my house, he's my problem. If I could just get away from him, I'm going to be okay. And that was the story of my life. I could never sustain anything. Friendships lasted 5 years, maybe. Marriages, 11 years. Jobs, 6 years. Everything in my history had a shelf life because I was broken on the inside. And I had no idea. And I kept trying to fix the outside, kept trying to change the outside. And so at the same time, I've got this thing happening, this physical reaction to when I drink, the world changes. And when I drink, I can't not drink anymore. I have to have more. And these cravings started, and this mental obsession started, and at the same time, I've got this hole in my soul that I didn't understand then was a spiritual malady. And so I was drinking one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, drinking wine out of a coffee cup, because somehow that made that normal. And at this point, I'm no longer taking showers. And those who know me know I'm a girly girl. And I didn't care about that stuff anymore. My kids were still in my life, but only because I supported them. This marriage had fallen apart, and we were still doing this back and forth, awful, sick, twisted thing. And I was standing looking out my kitchen window, and I just all of a sudden didn't want to drink anymore. I was so worn out and so tired. And I had to get sick to keep drinking. I was at that place. I had become physically dependent on alcohol because 5 o'clock could quickly become 12 o'clock and 12 o'clock could quickly become 9 o'clock. And I was drinking around the clock. I couldn't not drink. Everywhere I went, I had to have alcohol with me. When I went to family events, I had it in my purse. I didn't realize I clinked everywhere I went, but I did. And I can remember sitting in the parking lot at the food line to go in and get more wine and watching people go in and watching people with children who were smiling and who were happy. And I can remember sitting in that car with tears streaming down my face, going, God, I just want to be like that. I just want to be normal. I just don't want to have to drink anymore. And so that morning, it hit me that this is exactly what my father had experienced, because I had spent all these years not acknowledging how angry I was with him, how I felt like he had a choice and he chose to leave. And it hit me that I was going to leave exactly the same legacy for my children. But I didn't know what to do about that. And I was at that place that our book so beautifully talks about, that I couldn't live with alcohol anymore. I was so tired of it, but I couldn't live. I didn't have a clue how to live without it. The thought of not drinking, I didn't know how to do that, because I had spent my whole life having to have that spiritual experience that alcohol gave me to make me okay with me and to make me okay in my own skin. And I had this on and off relationship with this God. And that morning I said that prayer, God help me. And the answers were not immediate. I continued to drink round the clock. And on Thanksgiving Day 2011, that ex called me. And I think we were just picking a fight with each other, because that's what he did. But somehow the words came out of my mouth, and it was not of me. And I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I need help. And he had a lot of experience with 12-step programs, and I'll be forever grateful that he got me to you. And so I went to the club on Friday after Thanksgiving 2011, and I walked in. I had not showered in I don't know how long. He gave me a cup of coffee. I spilled it all over the floor. And I don't remember what was said. I remember that Kip H. was chairing, and I was sure he was drunk because he was just way too happy. I'd never seen people that happy who were sober, but he was. He is obnoxiously cheerful still today, but that's sobriety for you. And I don't know what was said, but I know and remember to this day how that room felt. And I remember hearing laughter, and I hadn't heard laughter in a really long time. And I remember the love I felt and the warmth I felt, and I haven't felt that in a really long time. And somebody said, get a book, and I thought, okay, is it story hour? But I got a book, and somebody said, pick up a chip, and that didn't make sense to me either. All that lingo we use when you first get here, I thought, are we playing poker? Like, I don't understand. But I went home, and I was detoxing myself, and I watched the clock. And 1 minute would pass, and I would think, I need a minute, because I was physically dependent on alcohol. And another minute would pass, and I would think, okay, I did that minute. And I went to the noon meeting, and it was a 12 and 12, and they were on step 12. And somehow they figured out I was new. I don't know how they knew that. Y'all are intuitive people. And they said, you're the most important person in the room. And I thought, well, finally somebody has figured that out. That's awesome. And they made that meeting about me. The whole meeting was about step one and was about alcoholism. And I started to feel a little bit of hope, because I had gotten to the place where my children were with me because I supported them. They didn't want anything to do with me. I didn't have anybody in my life anymore, and I wouldn't go to bars to drink because that might make me an alcoholic if I'm a female in a bar by myself. So I would just lock myself in the house, and I had picked out a phone pole to crash into. I didn't want to be here anymore. I just did not want to be here anymore. And that day, I felt just a glimmer, man, just a glimmer of hope. And somebody said, get a sponsor. And I thought, are you going to give me t-shirts and promotional stuff? Just none of it made any sense. But I didn't know what else to do. So I got into the meetings. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're an interesting bunch. It's the Jerry Springer Show every day. And so it was very entertaining. You all are still my favorite people on the face of the earth. And I started going to speaker meetings, and that's where I heard Dorothy O, and she was the first speaker I heard, and she walked in, and she had this beautiful red suit on, and I thought, because I had a business background, I thought, oh, gosh, they have flown her in from corporate New York AA to speak to us today. How cool is that? And her story is completely and totally different in terms of the details than mine. Completely polar opposite. But man, the pain was the same. The pain she described, and it was that language of the heart that you guys read about at the beginning of this meeting, and I heard it. I heard it, and I heard the hope. I heard the hope, and I thought for the first time in a long time, maybe if it could work for her, it can work for me. And that beautiful identification of one alcoholic to another, that magic started to work on me. Now, I had a little bit of trouble with the whole not drinking part, I will tell you. So I got into the fellowship. Somebody said, get a sponsor. Again, I thought that person was going to give me T-shirts. I didn't know what that meant, but I did it, but I didn't utilize that. I didn't do anything with steps. I just liked hanging out with y'all because y'all were a lot of fun. So I did the fellowship, and I did meetings. And I loved open discussion meetings because I could not wait to hear what I had to say. And so I would go. I remember one lunchtime meeting, there was a girl in there who had like, I don't know, 12 days, and I had like 27 days. And I spent longer talking than I've talked tonight, and it was not a speaker meeting, carrying on and on. And so that was me. I would go in and throw up all over everybody, but I kept coming because I could hear that, man, and I wanted to be with you. And so the fellowship drew me. It drew me in, and it kept me there. But I didn't have a sufficient substitute for what alcohol did for me. And so I went to a Christmas party at work, and somebody said, do you want a drink? They asked me the wrong question, right? And I took a drink. And so I didn't want to give up AA, though. So I decided that I was going to be the first person to drink and successfully work the program. So I was going to teach y'all how to do that, too, after I got it all figured out. So I would do that, and I would go to a meeting, and I would pick up a start over chip, and I would leave the meeting, and I would get drunk, and I'd go to another meeting that night, and I'd pick up a start over chip. And I will tell you, I did that every day, two or three times a day, for 2 weeks, every single day. And every single time I picked up a chip, you clapped. Every single time you were genuinely happy for me. Every single time you wanted me to come back, you hugged me, and you were sincere about that. And I kept waiting for you to tell me you were out of start over chips. I kept waiting for you to say, Cindy, we don't have any more. You need to go away. And nobody ever said that to me. Nobody ever said that to me. You welcomed me, and you loved me, and you told me to keep coming back. And so what I pray was my last drunk. I woke up on a Thursday night, and there were wine bottles all around me. And I didn't know where my kids were. I didn't know if it was day or night. And I had called and scheduled an appointment for an outpatient assessment the next day because people were starting to use the T word, treatment, and I had said I couldn't do treatment because I had a job that I wasn't working. I had kids that I wasn't taking care of, but I had all these reasons, right? All these buts, all these reasons why I couldn't. And that last time I drank, I woke up, and in that moment, I had a gift that was not of myself. It was absolutely from a power outside of me, and it was a desperation to not live that way anymore. And in that moment, I got that gift of willingness. And what I know today, with a little bit of experience, trying to help other people, is that I can't give that to anybody. Nobody could give that to me, but a power did that night. And I went to treatment, and I packed while I was drunk. So I took high heels, I took hair dye, fingernail polish, all this stuff. And I walked in the treatment center, and this crazy girl came up to me, and she went, "Hi, my name's Jennifer, and I'm going to be your roommate." And I thought, oh, God, she's drunk, too. We're messed up. And that person turned out to be my very best friend, and that friendship has lasted now almost 10 years. So I'm doubling my record for friendship. And I got into meetings. I got into the fellowship. I got into service work. I did a lot of service. But I didn't have the process of the steps in my life. And so I only had two sides of that triangle, and I was expecting the results of the three sides. But God put this person in my life when I was about a year sober, coming up on a year. This little blonde girl walked into the rooms one day, and she had the same mixture of snot and mascara that I'd had the year before when I went to treatment. And I saw the pain on her face, the pain of untreated alcoholism. And in that moment, somebody else's sobriety became more important to me. So I started sponsoring people. I had not been sponsored in the book. The sponsor I had at that time said, "I don't do the big book." And I thought, well, that's great. That's one less thing. That's awesome. But I was nuts, because for me, I know I'm a real alcoholic, because things get better on the outside when I stop drinking, but they get worse on the inside. But I started trying to help other alcoholics. And that's where this journey really started for me. And I started reading that book with somebody else. And that's where my recovery began. After a couple of years of that, I was, as my sponsor would tell you, so dry, I was a fire hazard. And because I didn't have the steps in my life working for me. And I was watching other people be transformed by them. And so I found the biggest, baddest, big book thumper in High Point. And I made a decision, because I knew at that point that I was dying and I was going to go back out and drink again. And I asked her to take me through this process, and she did. And we did it line by line and paragraph by paragraph. And I began to change, and I pray I'm still changing today. I feel like I have been all over the place tonight, and I'm so sorry for that. But what I will tell you is that my life today is a result of this process of the steps that has introduced me and put me in this intimate relationship with a power greater than me, has changed me. Those daughters that should not be in my life, they call me for advice. I was taking my daughter to the airport the other morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, for a business trip. And she said, "Mom," we started talking about recovery. And she said, "Mom, I want to tell you this." She said, "I was thinking about the person you are today. And I just want you to know, I would go through all the hell we went through of your drinking to get that same person. I didn't do that. You don't get from there to here. I have this job that God put in my life. I'm able to care for my mother in a way I never would have imagined possible. My life is so full today that my sponsor has to instruct me on resting. She has to instruct me on taking some time for myself, because my life is so incredibly full. And less than 10 years ago, I didn't have a life except me locked in my house drinking. I don't think I've done nearly enough of a job tonight to tell you what AA and Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. But I pray that if there's somebody on here that is hopeless and thinks this thing doesn't work, that you hear that it does. real fast because I had been taught to end on time. So relax, I'm going to. I'm watching the clock the whole time. But I wrote this that I'm going to close with when I was 6 months sober, preparing for my first year birthday, because, you know, you got to think ahead for that stuff. But I heard an Episcopal priest give his talk, and he said, "Do you know God sounds like an alcoholic?" And that hit me in a way. And so I hope that this can convey a little bit of the gratitude I have to you, because you've taught me how to live. You've taught me this formula of the steps that's given me a life. And I'm happily and usefully whole today, and I'm so grateful for that. This is called The Voice in the Rooms. There is a voice in these rooms. It speaks in a different vernacular. It uses different verbiage. It speaks of joy. It talks of peace. It shouts of restoration. It's the voice of the lawyer, the factory worker, the nurse, the homeless. It is male, it is female. It is the voice of the sinner. It is the voice of the saint. It is wisdom, it is peace. It tells me in a very simple way how to make sense of my existence. It tells me that I have a choice. It maps out the right road in the simplest fashion. It screams at me that I do not have to let my disease define me. It tells me that I matter. It points me to a power greater than myself who loves me beyond my comprehension. It is filled with laughter, love, and peace. It's why I keep coming back. This voice, it's God's voice, but it sounds like yours. Thanks for letting me share.